Brad Sessmatt Show, broadcasting live from the Skyview Network Studios.
It's the Brad Sessmatt Show on Sports 360 AZ and AZ Central Sports, becoming a Wednesday staple. That's Greg Esposito. I'm Jared Cohen filling in for Brad. We normally do the Dry Heat Check podcast each and every week, which you could check out on a myriad of platforms. We're all over the place, Espo.
We are. iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher. Anywhere you can type in the words Dry Heat Check, you'll find us.
That's what it is, and we want you to join. We want you to check it out. It's a lot of fun. We do it each and every week. But coming up today on the show for the Brad Sessmatt Show, we're going to talk Cards Patriots, maybe look ahead to Cardinals Buccaneers coming this weekend. Pedro Gomez, ESPN Baseball Insider, he'll join us coming up on the show. Kent Summers surprised us all, and he's released a book, which I think everyone's very excited about. Everyone loves Kent Summers and how great he is and the great work he does. 100 Things Cardinals Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. So we're going to talk to him about that coming up here in a little bit.
I'm going to bet I know about 95 of the 100 things.
So those five is going to be very interesting. And then finally, a segment that we do each and every week on the Dry Heat Check, the airing of grievances this week. Espo, you have a few things that you need to channel your inner Costanza and get off your chest.
I do every week, and I'm ready to do it.
Yeah, it's the thing is we have to limit you on the amount that you can do. So the Cardinals and the Patriots play on Sunday Night Football, Espo, and it's one of those hate to say we told you so situations. Last week we mentioned that we were a little bit concerned about not necessarily this game, but the preseason hype and the amount going into it. I'm driving it up to the Cardinals game on Sunday. I covered it, and I was listening to the pregame show. I can't remember which one it was.
But they start on Saturday nights now, and they go straight through to the game.
There are so many. Shout out to Luke Lipinski, who does the pregame show and the postgame show. He is there for about 8 hours in the day, but I talked to him at the game on Sunday, and it sounds like long days for him. Not that it's a bad thing, because it's a great gig for him, though. But I'm driving up, and I'm hearing a discussion about how the Panthers lost and how the Packers almost lost and the Seahawks were currently in a battle in the second half against the Dolphins and how important this is for Cardinals' pursuits of the number one seed. And I'm thinking to myself, they haven't even played a game yet. They have a really tough game ahead of them tonight. Why are we talking about the number one seed right now? They haven't even played a single snap in 2016 that counts for anything. Let's play the games first. This is what we talked about last week, and that was starting to drive us nuts a little bit. Sure enough, they come out extremely flat in the first quarter on both sides of the football, getting carved up by Julian Edelman, and ultimately lose the game, a game that they almost were able to salvage on a field goal late, but they ultimately lose, and now we're sitting here preaching, let's tone it back. Focus on the regular season and what needs to be accomplished in a tough regular season and not be thinking first round bye, Super Bowl, NFC Championship, glory, all that stuff, because so much needs to be earned and figured out before we can even start discussing it.
Well, like you said, we've been preaching that since the preseason, but there were two rules that everybody went against. They forgot. Two NFL rules that always hold true. Don't bet against Bill Belichick, and the Cardinals will always fall short of their hype. This is always held true in the NFL, and we all forgot it going into week one. Okay, not all of us, but some of us around town forgot that and forgot that mentality. And nationally, too, the Cardinals across the board were the favorite pick in that game. I think the line in
nine
that game was 9.5 going into it.
They didn't beat very many teams by 10-plus points last year.
And when you have Bill Belichick, I don't care if you're running out the Sisters of the Poor with him. He's going to have a scheme where they're at least in the game towards the end. You know, they figured out a way to pick on the Cardinals' secondary, which we all knew was a potential issue for them going into this season. nothing happened in game one to make me believe differently in that fact. Now, you've got Tyrann Mathieu coming off injury. He wasn't the same guy. They weren't using him the same way in week one. He will get there. You know, they didn't throw an awful lot at Patrick Peterson, but
no, and teams won't.
No, but it's the other cornerback position that is going to continue to be a sore spot unless Steve Keim pulls off some of his in-season magic like he has in the past. Now, I'm not saying everybody should panic, get off the bandwagon, and freak out, but reset, pump the brakes, reset those expectations. Look at each week as they need to prove themselves. If they're sitting at 9-1, you know, in going into week 11, all right, then you can crank up the hype machine again. But as of right now, they still have a lot to prove. That offense, outside of Larry Fitzgerald and David Johnson for flashes, was fairly mundane. It was not the passing game that you'd come to expect. Now, part of that's the Patriots and their defensive scheme. They really held the Cardinals' deep ball in check.
You got to give them credit for that.
But I, at times, was somewhat bored watching that game. There was not the excitement that we saw last year. You expected the kind of scoring output you saw in the Raiders game or the ASU game last weekend from this Cardinals offense, and they came out, and I think they're not on the same page yet. They need to find themselves against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers this weekend. If they come out flat, they play similar to the way they did in week one, and they're sitting at 0-2, then I'm breaking the glass in case of emergency, because I think we're at a point where you're going to have to start to wonder about the long-term health of this of the team. But right now, I'm not worried. They had one game.
Yeah.
It was a marginally bad game against a football genius in Bill Belichick. But the expectations, like you were talking about, worrying about scoreboard watching in week one is ridiculous. And this helps reset that.
There were things in that game that I think people are overreacting to. There were a couple situations that are a little bit concerning. You know, Bruce Arians had the comment that he was talking about Michael Floyd, where he altered a route, put his hand up because he thought it was open, but Palmer was expecting him to do something different, ended up being an incompletion.
Yeah.
You know, you have that happen once, it doesn't happen again, or you get on the same page next time. I will say this, though. I am unbelievably concerned with special teams. Like, beyond concerned. Because special teams is the kind of the caveat which makes great teams and Super Bowl teams puts the cherry on top, if you will. Their punting was horrible. Now, we came out and found out that Drew Butler was hurt, but 36 yards per punt average on five punts is pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
Kickoff returns, I should say. Andre Ellington averaged, I think his best return was out to the 21.
Yeah, did he forget that now the touchback goes to the 25?
To the 25.
And did somebody forget to tell him it's all right to take a knee in the end zone? I get he and hasn't done it a lot. He's a running back by trade, but come on, man.
And it's not just on Ellington, though. I don't know how many times when Ellington would come out of the end zone, there were three or four guys around him. Are the guys not blocking for these people? Are they just saying, all right, go right ahead and have at him? The blocking on kickoffs was horrible. And, of course, the long snapping situation needs to be brought up, because you never talk about why am I blanking out of state?
Well, right, you never
now
talk about any long snapper or any kicker until there's an issue.
We didn't talk about Mike Leach until there was an issue, and we got so comfortable with him the last 8 years that you just expect it to be fine, and you don't realize what you've got until it's gone. And Kanadeh with the low snap was the issue with that field goal. Catanzaro can put it on himself, and Butler could say, I could have handled it better. That is on Kanadeh, without question. And you can't have that. It concerns me that when the situation is at its most intense, that's what you get. You know, there are going to be more games this season where field goals are going to be the difference in games.
Yep.
Heck, extra points could be the difference in games down the stretch of the season. And if that's what we have to work with, that can be a huge concern. So if I'm going to be overreacting to this loss in any way, it's going to be great concern in what this special teams has shown, not just in the first game, but in the preseason, this was an issue as well.
Well, it concerns me that Steve Keim didn't do what he usually does and bring in some kind of veteran to compete for that spot. It was on two young guys, two fairly inexperienced guys in the preseason, and you see that happen in week one, and it wasn't a surprise to me. I turned to my in-laws who was watching the game with, and I said, they're going to miss this field goal. There's going to be some kind of issue with this field goal. I just feel it when you have a young guy on a big stage in his first real test as the long snapper. And it was just, it was bad. And they need to decide, can he grow or do they need to address that? Because your point, extra points aren't easy now. They're 33 yards out. One bad snap on an extra point even can change the face of this season.
That's Greg Esposito. I'm Jared Cohen. We're filling in for Brad Sesmat today. Coming up next on the show, our ESPN baseball insider Pedro Gomez joins us like he does each and every week. Hey, a lot of Diamondbacks pitchers have been on display. Young guys, has any of them proved that they can be part of this team going forward? We'll talk about that with Pedro coming up up next with Espo. I'm Jared, filling in for Brad.
It's time to talk Arizona Diamondbacks and Major League Baseball with ESPN insider Pedro Gomez. Here's Brad Sesmat.
Pedro Gomez joins us like he does each and every week here on the Brad Sesmat Show. That's Greg Esposito. I'm Jared Cohen filling in for Brad here on this Wednesday. And Pedro, let's get things started here. So we were able to catch up last week, and we talked about Shelby Miller like we've done so many times here this season. So Shelby gets shelled again. No need to make light of the situation there. But I'm asking, he went down to AAA. It seemed like he might have solved some things. It's looking like he didn't. Was anything solved? And is it getting to the point where it's becoming extremely worrisome with this pitcher?
Well, you have to worry when the results aren't, you know, you're not moving forward. And that's what every ball club always worries about with a pitcher. I will say this, though, that this is a lost season. You're going to just throw this one away. And, you know, they've invested too much, not financially, but in terms of what they gave Atlanta to get Shelby Miller. They've invested way too much to just toss this away over the winter. I think that unless a club and another club blows them away with an offer, Shelby Miller will in all likelihood be back with the Diamondbacks next season. So it's really a matter of trying to work the mental side. And it, by all accounts, everyone I've talked to in the game strongly believes that it is mental with Shelby Miller. It's about the expectations that were placed on him before the season. It's about the expectations the Diamondbacks had as a ball club and how much of that relied on Shelby Miller. And he just had trouble with it. So, you know, there are mental coaches. There are things that can be done that can try to move forward. And I will say this about Tony La Russa, Dave Stewart, who are all part of the Diamondbacks organization. The Oakland A's, which is where they all started together, they were one of the very first clubs, if not the very first club, to incorporate psychology into players' performances. There was a guy who's passed away named Harvey Dorfman. You can look up, he's written some books on the subjects and was really well renowned within baseball circles for helping guys mentally. And the A's were big, big believers in this. So it would not surprise me at all if that were incorporated into Shelby Miller's offseason.
If the mental side is so important, and what we think may be the problem going on with Shelby Miller, is there any chance that they just put him on the shelf for the rest of the year? Because I can't imagine going out there and continually giving up this many runs is helping that mental state at all.
Well, but I think at this point, like I said, this season is a lost season. And you don't want to just take someone out of the rotation and say, okay, just go start your vacation now. Go start your off season now. It's still therapeutic to get on the mound. That's what a pitcher does. And he has to only do it once every 5 days. It's not like a position player who can be out there every day. So when it comes to the therapeutic portion, being on the mound is always better than not being on the mound. I would be really surprised if he doesn't take his final few starts these last 3 weeks.
Well, we talk about
half weeks.
We talk about the mental side with the players, but in the front office, how difficult is it to be a general manager? I wonder this because it's real easy for us to sit here and criticize, but it's got to be extremely difficult on the other side of things too.
Well, and you know, you look at a guy like Dave Stewart, who has not been on the baseball side, the Major League Baseball side, for well over a decade. You know, he was an agent before he took over the role as the D-backs GM. And I talk to people who are assistant GMs who have been lifetime people in front offices, and the first thing they say is, it looks so glamorous from the outside, but you're not just responsible for the big league roster. You're responsible for six different ball clubs within your organization when you include all the minor league teams. And then you're in charge of instructional league and of guys who are at extended fall and players who are at the Dominican summer league. There's so much more. It's like an iceberg. You only see the top of it on the surface, but if you were to look below, it is, you know, 8-10 times larger below the surface than it is above. And that's the part that really can, you know, weigh you down if you have not been prepared for this role. And as much as I respect Dave Stewart and have always had a great relationship with him, I covered him when he was a pitcher with the Oakland A's when I was an A's beat writer years ago. But you know, there's a reason that assistant general managers get promoted to the role of general manager, because they've already had the training in knowing what the job truly entails. And to just parachute in after you've been out of Major League Baseball for so long, I've talked to people in other front offices who say it's not nearly as I don't want to say the word easy, because it is difficult, and he knew it was difficult, but there's something to that job that you can't get from looking at it from the outside. You can only get it from being on the inside. And that's why so many general managers have been scouting directors and in charge of the draft. And, you know, you have your tentacles in every aspect. You don't just become a GM out of the blue. And that's I think that's been really difficult for someone like Dave Stewart.
It's Pedro Gomez. He joins us each and every week, our ESPN Baseball Insider. Pedro, I'd like to talk about Archie Bradley a little bit. He has not been dominant by any means, but this is a guy that is a former top prospect in the organization, a top 10 prospect in baseball when he first came out. Obviously, he got hit in the face, and there was a lot of that he needed to come back from all that. I'm just wondering, have we seen enough of Archie Bradley to know what we're getting out of him, or is there still a ceiling that's a little bit higher than we've seen to this point in his major league career?
Oh, there has to be a higher ceiling. There's no doubt about it, because guys who are taken within the first 10 or 15 picks in the first round tend to have a really high ceiling. It doesn't mean that they're going to always succeed, but when you look at the Diamondbacks, they've had less than enough patience with a lot of their higher picks. Whether it was Trevor Bauer, whether it was Max Scherzer, you know, they've just gotten rid of too many picks that were high in the draft, and you've got to kind of let them stew a little bit in the pot before you decide, no, it's not going to work. I think with Archie Bradley, he's going to get more because of those names that I mentioned, where the Diamondbacks just didn't have patience and got rid of guys. And you could almost throw Dansby Swanson in that list as well, even though he was only here for a few months with the Diamondbacks.
Tukey Toussaint, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're talking about a lot of top 10 type picks. And just think if the Royals hadn't been patient with someone like Eric Hosmer, who was a number 3 overall pick, or Mike Moustakas, who was a number 2 overall pick, who, by the way, did remember go down to the minors as recently as 2 years ago because he was struggling. It doesn't mean you just give up on a guy, because look what Moustakas ended up doing for the Royals in September and October of last year. You know, you've got to hang on, and you've got to trust that you picked the right guy. So I think Archie Bradley is definitely going to get more time to try to prove himself. Plus, he's under control for a very low salary still. You know, he still doesn't have arbitration. So he's making about a little over $500,000 a year. You've got to wait to see what you have more. And, you know, there's been little flashes like two starts ago where he showed, hey, look, you know, look what he did. And then you had the last start where it wasn't nearly as good, only three innings against the Giants and he was out. So you've got to give him a little time. Young pitchers take time to develop. It's rare when you get a Roger Clemens or a Dwight Gooden, you know, the players that are Clayton Kershaw who just emerge and boom, they're already stars from the get-go. Those are the rarities. The reality is that a lot of pitchers, it takes time to learn how to pitch at the major league level. And Bradley is, you know, he's auditioning. There's no doubt about that. He's auditioning for next season, but you've got to think that he's probably showing a little more flashes of positive than negative right now. And that's what the Diamondbacks are looking for. Is he moving forward? Is he moving the chains, so to speak? And I would say that Bradley probably is moving the chains forward and will come to spring next year, still having to prove himself, but in a better position.
All right, we've talked the serious. Now I got to ask you the fun here. Did you see Adrian Beltre's one-need home run last night?
You know, it's not the first time he's done it either. It's crazy. He you know, people ask me, hey, will you vote for Adrian Beltre for the Hall of Fame? You know, I obviously have 5 years until after he's played his last game, but I would say right now I'm absolutely leaning in that direction because I think he has been a phenomenal, phenomenal major league player throughout his career. And, you know, those are the things that you just, your jaw drops and your head shakes. You're like, how can he do that? How can he have one knee on the ground and hit the ball out of the park? And yet, if you look it up, it's not the first time he's done it.
And it wasn't like he just barely hit it out. He crushed that thing, too.
And Pedro, you're on to something. I think that he is a Hall of Famer, no question. I mean, he just doesn't stop. He just keeps going every year.
Yeah.
I mean, last year he had, I think it was a thumb injury that slowed him a little bit. And this year he was healthy. And now he's three RBIs away from being a 30 home run, 100 RBI, 300 hitter. At what age? What is he now? Like 38?
Yeah, he's 40? 38-ish, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's incredible what he's doing and the time of year he's doing it now for the Rangers in this crazy AL West. He's been like putting up MVP level status right now with what he's doing.
Oh, he is the MVP of the Rangers. There's no doubt about that. You know, when your best player works harder than anybody, that sets such an example for everyone in the organization that, holy cow, this guy's 38. He's still great. And look how hard he works. If you're Rougned Odor and you're 22, you have to look over and say, if he's busting his ass that much, I have to do equal, if not more, because I'm 15, 16 years younger than him. So, yeah, what Beltre brings to a ball club is more than just what you see on the field. It's the stuff behind the scenes as well. I've talked to John Daniels, the Rangers general manager, about him specifically, and Daniels just shakes his head and is so thankful and that they have him under contract still, which is one of the reasons it was important for the Rangers to give him a 2-year extension before this year so that they still have him for 2 more years. And it's almost like Tom Brady where you're waiting for age to catch up and yet you don't see it
not happening
at any point still.
It's really crazy stuff. You mentioned young guys. Last year was like the year of the call-up, Pedro, when you looked at Chris Bryant and Carlos Carrera and Schwarber for the Cubs as well, who didn't start the year on the major league roster, but ultimately made big impacts in the playoffs.
I would include Francisco Lindor on that list.
Lindor, yes, that's another great name. Who are guys this year that got called up that have some staying power? And I know it's not like last year was, but is there anyone this year who got called up and not only has staying power, but could end up making a big impact in this postseason coming up?
I mean, he didn't get called up this year. He got called up last year in September, but Corey Seager has definitely, you know, put himself out there as somebody that looks like he's going to be a star for a long, long time. Shoot, you've caught me off guard a little bit here.
Sorry about
that. I know I'm racking my brain. You know what? I would say Gabby Sanchez with the Yankees. You know, I think he's hit 13 home runs already, and he's only been up about 5 or 6 weeks. that is certainly somebody.
Some guys on the Red Sox, right, with Moncada and Benintendi.
Benintendi. I know he got hurt. He just got put back on the active roster from the DL. He looked good for that 10 days or so that he first came up. Gabby Sanchez with the Yankees certainly looks like somebody. It's always great for baseball when you see the wheel turning and you see new guys coming up and succeeding. And that's the best, one of the best parts about baseball is watching those guys come up and do their thing. And, it's remarkable, and it shows you how good some of these guys are that are coming up.
Pedro, thank you so much for your time. As always really interesting stuff. We appreciate it and look forward to next week as well.
Okay, guys, take care.
That's ESPN MLB insider Pedro Gomez joins us each and every week on the show. That's Greg Esposito. I'm Jared Cohen. We're filling in for Brad Sesmat today on Sports 360 AZ and AZ Central Sports. It's the Brad Sesmat Show on Sports 360 AZ and AZ Central Sports. That's Greg Esposito. I'm Jared Cohen. We're filling in for Brad on the show today. We're really excited now to be joined by Kent Summers. Kent Summers, a beat writer for the Arizona Republic, for the Arizona Cardinals. Been doing it for a long time and is one of the best in the business. And something that I think a lot of us didn't expect, it kind of came out of nowhere, but Kent, you're releasing a book, which I think every Cardinals fan out there is just absolutely ecstatic about. It's 100 Things Cardinals Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. And it's also a foreword by Larry Fitzgerald, so that should make it fun. Tell us how this all came about and how much fun are you looking forward to getting the feedback about it?
Thanks for having me on. I started work on it in early 2015 and finished it up at the end of the year. And that's kind of the process. It takes this long, and it's officially released tomorrow. It should be in places where people usually buy books. It's on Amazon right now, and you can get it there and get it to you within a couple of days. And it was a lot of fun to write the book. I covered a lot of the events in the book, but also, you know, it dips back into how the team was founded, some interesting stories from the 30s and 40s and St. Louis days, and of course a lot of things that have happened in the last 20 years since I've been covering the team. So I think fans will like it. It's a lot of things I learned doing the book that I really had no idea about that happened in team history.
All right. I've been a fan of the team, Kent, since 88. Went through the Sun Devil Stadium days. I feel like I know everything there is to know. Am I going to find some things in here that are going to totally just catch me off guard?
I think you'll find some maybe behind the scenes things on events you already knew about. You know, I think talking to some players from those eras, you know, the Jake Plummers, the Kurt Warners and Aeneas Williams, and, you know, just some very interesting stories about, you know, Aeneas Williams, for instance, third round pick out of Southern, came to training camp and was so nervous he wasn't going to make the team. He went and asked his position coach, Jim Johnson, you know, am I going to get cut? And Johnson started laughing at him, saying, get cut. You're going to start the opener. So just a lot of fun anecdotes like that. You know, Larry Wilson, their great safety, talking about his days and why he enjoyed playing with no teeth. And he said it was great. He goes, because if I ever had a problem, I just took my dentures in, had them fixed, and picked them up a couple of days later. I didn't have to worry about it on game day. So wow. Just a lot of neat stories. I had fun doing it.
Okay, is one of the 100 things that we need to do is own a Tom Tupa jersey? Just wondering.
That would have been great. Do you have one?
I don't, but it's one of the few things I want to actually accomplish before I leave this earth is owning a Tom Tupa jersey.
That was one of the most, oddly, one of the most challenging things of the book, are giving people some, you know, Cardinal fans, you know, things they should do, you know. And, I've had great suggestions after the book came out. Somebody suggested I have them learn how to make a Carson Palmer cocktail, which is, I guess, an Arnold Palmer, only it has vodka and grenadine to make it red. I guess that's a popular drink out on the Great Lawn when people pregame. So
yeah, and
it's been kind of fun since just interacting with fans. Yeah.
The great thing about that cocktail, too, is if it's in Cincinnati, it gets intercepted on the way to the person it's supposed to go to.
There it was. Kent Summers joining us. Go ahead, Kent.
The fun things to do. I mean, they're kind of, you know, whimsical, like, you know, memorize Denny Green's, you know, Monday Night Meltdown and all of that stuff brings back some memories.
It should be a lot of fun to check it out. It's 100 Things Cardinals Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die from Kent Summers. He joins us now on the show, and Kent's going to be doing a book signing around this coming Saturday. It's going to be at the Barnes & Noble off 90th Street and Scottsdale, over in Scottsdale. So you'll have to go check that out and get it autographed by Kent Summers, which would be really cool. I want to know more about...
I'd love it if somebody besides my family showed up.
I think you'll find that a lot of people are going to. It had quite the buzz on social media about it yesterday when you first released it. I want to know more about Larry Fitzgerald his involvement in this and what he did to kind of help you out.
Yeah, he was very, very nice. I asked him if he would be interested in writing the foreword, and he said he would. And I thought he was it's really good. It talks about his, you know, first 12 years in the organization and what it was like when he came here and how sort of downtrodden the organization is and just the tremendous growth he's seen. And he even talks about an anecdote in there about how I got him fined $10,000 by the league for leaving the locker room after games before talking to me. So he always teases me that I cost him $10,000, but we still talk. So, you know,
no hard feelings.
We apparently have moved on. Yeah.
Is part of the deal you're giving him the first $10,000 out of the book for writing the foreword to pay it back?
I don't want to give him any ideas.
we'll keep that on the DL. Maybe we'll edit that out after this.
Well, talking about Larry, does anything this guy does surprise you? I mean, week one, he carries the offense. He gets his 99th and 100th touchdown, and that 100th one was spectacular. Does anything with him surprise you anymore?
Not really. You know, you as somebody who's covered him for a long time, you look for signs of decay. You look for, you know, has he lost something? Is he, you know, does he not have the, you know, the hand-eye coordination or the ability to run after the catch that he used to? And he shows no signs of it. I mean, the one catch he made last Sunday night where, you know, he barely got his head around and the ball was sort of behind him and he still caught it, you know, to be able to watch that and not only in games but in practices for over 12 years has been amazing. There have been many times that, you know, you're on the sideline with other reporters and you just kind of look and say, did he actually just do that? Was that real? So yeah, it's pretty amazing, and obviously when he does something, it just electrifies that crowd at University of Phoenix Stadium.
Ken Summers joins us here on the Brad Sesmatch Show. Espo and Jared filling in here for Brad. Now, staying on the topic of what we've seen here from the Cardinals, one game down, Brandon Williams was targeted. He had some missed assignments. We knew there'd be some hiccups with him on him developing and being ready for this level of play quickly. However, if it costs you points, which ultimately costs you games, is the concern level a little high right now, him being opposite of Patrick Peterson?
I think it has to be. No question. We saw him struggle at times through the preseason and obviously Sunday night where, you know, he blew a coverage, thought he had help behind him when he was really in man-to-man and the one time where he missed a tackle. There's just not a whole lot they can do about it right now. I mean, there aren't any corners on the street. You have to kind of wonder if they miscalculated the position a bit. And they've had some bad luck there. You know, Justin Bethel goes... aggravates a foot injury, you know, before camp, and you know, then Alan Ball gets hurt and Mike Jenkins gets hurt, and you know, just some bad luck. So we'll see where that develops. I thought the game plan was a little curious defensively last week. I was a little surprised they didn't go after Garoppolo more and play more press man coverage and try to get at him and make life more uncomfortable for him. They seem to play off of receivers more than I've seen Cardinals teams usually do under Bruce Arians. So we'll see if that changes this week with Jameis Winston and the Buccaneers coming to town.
Now, do you think this loss could have actually been a good thing for this team to kind of reset the mentality? Because it felt like a lot of hype going into this year. They were believing in a lot of it as well. Could this be a benefit to this team?
You know, I don't know that you could ever say losing a home game could benefit. It certainly should, you know, get their minds right if that was the problem last Sunday. I mean, I question if it really was, but yeah, maybe so. I think, you know, maybe this team got caught up in all the Super Bowl talk. I'm not sure, and lost focus on the moment, on the process, et cetera. Maybe Bruce Arians can use that to, you know, sort of bring them back to earth. But I don't know if that was really the problem last week. I mean, the Patriots are the Patriots. We, even without Tom Brady, and, you know, you give Bill Belichick a whole offseason to prepare for an opening game, you sort of knew it was going to be a tough test.
John Brown was pretty much a non-factor in this game. He was, I think, 0 for his first five in terms of targets, and he didn't have his first catch until the fourth quarter. Is there a health issue, health concern still around that concussion? Is he playing more tentatively because of the concussion? Is there stuff to be concerned about with John Brown, or is this just an off game for everyone in the offense, including one of their promising receivers?
Well, I think he's fine, you know, without being able to crawl inside his head. I think he's fine health-wise. I think the problem was you could see the lack of work that he had in the preseason and the lack of timing between he and Carson Palmer. There was, you know, I think Carson overthrew him once and then John Brown had the ball stripped from him once and kind of had it knocked away another time. I mean, when they did try to go deep to him three or four times, they were just off by a few yards. And I don't know that happens if he's healthy through the preseason. And so that's what Bruce Arians thinks, that it's, you know, it's just a matter of, you know, not playing in the preseason. And, you know, it's a question overall with this team. That's what I wrote today on AZ Central. You know, did the starters on this team play enough in the preseason? I mean, if you compare it to what Belichick did with the Patriots, Cardinals starters played far less in the preseason. And you know, the sloppiness showed up on Sunday, the miscommunication between Palmer and receivers, all the missed tackles, missed assignments on defense, et cetera.
Kent Summers has his book that has been released, 100 Things Cardinals Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. The foreword is by Larry Fitzgerald, and he is going to be having a book signing at Barnes & Noble. That's off 90th Street in Scottsdale. You could check it out and pick up the book, get an autograph from Kent. And I think I could speak for a lot of us that I, too, born and raised here and have been around this team for my entire life. And it's been fun. It's going to be fun to relive a lot of the history, learn some new things and read this book. I'm excited about it, Ken.
I'm hopping on Amazon right now to buy it. So.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's you know, it's not an expensive book. It's $15. It'd be a great gift for people. It'd be great to put in your bathroom. You know, it's a nice little bathroom reader or coffee table book, you know. So, yeah, and I appreciate you guys having me on to talk about it.
Ken, thanks so much. We appreciate it. And we'll see you on Sunday against Tampa Bay.
Sounds good. Thanks, guys.
I got to tell you, it would be a great bathroom book for those years in the late 80s, early 90s where they played. If there's a lot of history about that, the smell is perfect for that room.
And
a little bit of a stinker.
And Espo's gone off the deep end here.
Per usual.
It's the Brad Sesmatt Show on Sports 360 AZ and AZ Central Sports. Coming up next, a segment that we hold near and dear to our heart on the Dry Heat Check podcast. It is the airing of grievances. Espo each and every week has about 50 things he'd like to get off his chest, and we have to limit him to 2, maybe 3 if we're in a good mood. That's what's coming up next here on Sports 360 AZ and AZ Central Sports. It's the Brad Sesmatt Show on Sports 360 AZ and AZ Central Sports. My name is Jared Cohen. That's Greg Esposito. We're filling in for Brad on this Wednesday. Again, special thanks to Kent Summers for joining us. Also, Pedro Gomez here on the show today. We do it each and every week, Espo. We call it the airing of grievances. And it's when we bring to life some things that are just really just bothering you that you just want to get off your chest. I'll bring some sometimes, but I'm not as angry of a person as you are.
I don't like that I'm being painted as this angry human being that has some kind
all of these issues.
It's not anger. It's concern for the world that we live in.
You know what? If you paint it that way, you know what? You're right. It's concern for the well-being of our society. It's wanting to bring to life things that might be off that you want to be corrected and made right. So you know what? I apologize. I am very sorry for having that tone and painting you in a light that is just not accurate.
If we had a producer right now, I'd say, hey, can we clip that so we could play it back? let me look at this. Let me get into this. My first one, and it is super serious, and it's something that we need to get to the bottom of, and we need fixed here. Let's be frank about this.
Okay, let's be frank then.
What is with all these teams using colors for their uniforms that aren't their team colors?
Oh, this is very
serious. Can you please explain this to me? The ASU Sun Devils last week came out looking like the Pittsburgh Steelers. Maroon and gold is ASU's colors. They came out in black and yellow uniforms.
With a lot of white, too, yeah.
I don't understand. I get it. Oh, recruiting. Make all the uniforms you want. Make them as crazy as you want. As long as you stick to the colors that everybody knows is your team. Why do we have to venture so far out from that? Not to mention, Adidas can't figure out how to sew on some numbers on the front of an ASU jersey.
Screen printed,
their
right?
Screen, it is not 1988. This isn't champions putting together the uniforms. Let's actually sew those numbers on the uniforms, Adidas, because even before the game, it looks like somebody packed them in a suitcase, crumpled them up, and then put them on the players.
I said that last year when we first saw them. They looked like knockoff jerseys.
They looked like
the jerseys that people make on their own and try to sell them.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's what those jerseys, they looked like knockoff versions of the Nike jerseys they had the years prior.
Well, and it looks ridiculous. And you know what? U of A's numbers, they look like they were printed on a dot matrix printer from the early 90s as well. So they're not off the hook. But then, back to the colors, you look at it, and the Arizona Cardinals this week and the entire NFL came out with what they're calling the Color Rush.
Well, they did that last year, too.
They did, for teams that were playing on Thursday nights. The Cardinals didn't have one. It wasn't every team, but a handful of teams did. They were atrocious, especially in the Bills-Jets game,
yeah,
where colorblind people couldn't tell the difference between the two uniforms because of the red and the green that they used. But,
and also the field and the players, too, right?
Oh,
wasn't
yeah.
that an issue? The giant screen jerseys and the field they were playing on, people who were colorblind were having issues with that?
It was just bad in general. But then the Cardinals come out, and they look like what the Atlanta Falcons should look like. Remember the old school black and red Atlanta Falcons jerseys during the Deion Sanders days? Their color rush uniform looks like that. I don't quite understand. I get it. Black uniforms sell. They're a hot ticket item. But man, give me some kind of all red uniform or some play with red and then yellow numbers, because yellow is a color for the Cardinals. Incorporate it more. Give me something that fits the color scheme more instead of the general black. It happened with the Phoenix Suns while I was there. They released an all black uniform that lacked many of the touches that we've come to know for the Phoenix Suns. Just stick to the color palette that is your team. We bleed those colors. I don't say I bleed black and red when I talk about the Cardinals, or if somebody's an ASU fan, they don't say, hey, I bleed black and a yellowish gold. No, maroon and gold and red and white for the Cardinals. Or, you know, that's what you believe.
You said yellow is a Cardinals color. When in their history have they had, other than when the flag was printed or the beak of the logo,
but
they've never had uniform that had yellow incorporated.
Exactly my point.
Well, and here's the thing, black, since they went to the new uniform that they currently have when they moved into the new stadium, has always been part of the uniform as the trim. So if anything, black being a jersey as opposed to yellow being in the jersey would be more prevalent, because black has been prevalent in their uniform for many years now.
I must have missed all those Cardinals flying around that are completely black with a slight touch of red on it.
Those would be sweet-looking
Cardinals.
Those are
Cardinals. Blackbirds or Falcons. They're not Cardinals, all right?
I'm with you that kind of a dynamic red uniform would have looked kind of cool, but they already wear red. I actually think that those Color Rush uniforms look pretty sweet. I mean, I don't know if you saw the Broncos Broncos won, but they went to the old school Bronco with the Navy helmet and the really vibrant orange uniforms.
Which is a historic thing. It's their Orange Crush uniforms. The Patriots, they kept with the same color scheme, but it was more of the striping that you saw in their traditional. Why not give me something that looked a little bit more like the traditional Cardinals red or white uniform and give me just some kind of take on that? You don't have to always default to the black. Now, I want to get to one other thing. It also involves the Cardinals. This is another airing of grievance. In terms of on Sunday, before the Cardinals game in the morning, we hear a report that Larry Fitzgerald is likely to retire at the end of the year. He's told people close to him that that's his decision, and he's already come to it. And then, you know, it frustrates me because later on it came out, and even Larry Fitzgerald's father directly refuted it, that it doesn't sound like this is true at all, that he hasn't told people close to him. Now, I get every reporter has sources. Everybody hears things, and sometimes it isn't correct. But I think in our current society, the desire to be first rather than be right has become so prevalent that we're getting into misinformation getting out there when, you know, if you fact checked it a little further, that may not be the case. And then what happens is it spirals into, and this is what really upset me, the Sporting News sending out a tweet that Larry Fitzgerald has announced he's retiring at the end of the year, which is completely irresponsible because Larry Fitzgerald hadn't said anything. It was a report, and then if you click through the link, it was actually just a really bad aggregation of the original story. I'm sorry, but that's irresponsible. And we even saw it over the weekend here in town. A local reporter covering high school football tweeted out that the top quarterback prospect, Ryan Kelly, in Arizona was injured so severely that he was taken to the hospital. Apparently, it was based on a text that he got and didn't really know the information. He trusted it, got burned because Kelly wasn't in the hospital, wasn't injured. It was misinformation. The desire to be first rather than to be right is becoming very dangerous, not only in our medium, but across media, because you know what? Being first is forgotten. But if you get it wrong, people don't forget that, and people should be more careful because it will spread like wildfire, and you alarm fans as well in the case of, uh-oh, Larry Fitzgerald's retiring. Now, he played Sunday night like he was playing one of his last games ever and played really hard, but you got to think about this and really consider what you're putting out there.
That's Greg Esposito. I'm Jared Cohen, filling in for Brad Sesmet on the show today. Brad should be back tomorrow. Appreciate it, getting the opportunity to fill in for him today. Pedro Gomez, thank you very much. Kent Summers was awesome. Make sure you check out his book signing, which is coming up this weekend at the Barnes & Noble in Scottsdale off 90th Street. I believe that's off, you know, kind of Shea in the 101
it
area.
It is. 1 to 2 o'clock.
1 to 2 o'clock, yes. So make sure you check that out. Espo, appreciate it as always.
Always fun.
Thanks to Eric. Jared, I'm Jared. Have yourself a great Wednesday, and we'll catch you tomorrow.